This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Indiana Landmarks has saved everything from small but historically significant single-family homes to the enormous West Baden Springs Hotel in French Lick. And they just put out a new book of some of their proudest accomplishments called Indiana Landmarks Rescued and Restored. Later this hour, we'll hear from the organization's president and one of the editors of the book. But first, we just wanted to get a little perspective on what it takes to get a site back from the brink of destruction. Ed Norman and Tim Parnell are the Indianapolis couple who bought and restored the Alber House, the oldest surviving house in Wabash, Indiana. And they join us now. Hi, Ed.
Good morning.
And hello to you, Tim.
Good morning.
And if you want to be a part of the conversation today, find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it in front of our live panel later this hour. Again, that's 866-476-3881. So, Tim, can you start off by just telling us some of the history behind the house you bought in Wabash, the Alber House?
Some of the history, it was built by Philip Alber in 1848, and it's noted that it was built within 10 days from start to finish. He was a brick mason, and it sits right on the edge of a railroad station. So the upstairs was used as a residence, and the downstairs was used kind of as a beer pub, place for people that would ride the train to get off the train and to come in and to have a beer. And so it's 172 years old. It's been vacant for about 15 years, and Landmarks provided a great opportunity. They came in, they restored the outside, and they've given us an opportunity to do some inside finish work. So
I mean, do we know anything about, say, the business, the cafe? Was it a successful business back in the day?
It seemed to be a successful business, Ed.
Yes, there was a cafe with a kitchen and a beer garden in the back. We don't have any of the details as far as how long they were even in business, but, you know, that was when Wabash was kind of a young, booming town, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Ed, you're from Wabash, right?
Yes, I grew up outside of Wabash, closer to a little town called La Grove.
And do you remember seeing the house a lot growing up?
You know, I did pass by it once in a while, and it always kind of stood out because it is unusual in its design. It looks like something more from East Coast than it does from the Midwest, I think.
What makes you say that? It is kind of a plain building. It looks just kind of utilitarian.
Yeah, it has the double steps up the front to a middle door. So it's almost like a split level with the basement, two windows in the front exposed that go into what was the pub and kitchen in the basement that was accessible from the back. And then from the front, the living space was accessible through the double stairway that go up to a center door. Brick house, limestone foundation, pretty solid.
Tim, I understand that you and Ed had worked with Indiana Landmarks before you showed interest in this house. What'd you do with them in the past?
Well, it was primarily Ed, and he can give you a little bit more background on that.
I'm a freelance graphic designer who's worked with Indiana Landmarks for quite a few years on a lot of their projects and you know, some of their big saves like West Baden and some of the smaller ones, but great organization. They were great client and good people to work with.
Tim, what was it about this house that made you want to make this commitment?
You know, it was the outside. I think the look of the outside was unique, as they had talked about. It was something that you typically do not see in the Midwest. I'm originally from the South, and so you definitely wouldn't see anything in Alabama like that. My sister-in-law, Christy Norman, thought the house was great, and we had looked at another property, and she took us to this house, and I fell in love instantly, and I think it followed suit right behind me. But it was just something unique about the house, and it was small, but it was interesting, and I could just visualize a lot of possibilities.
So, Ed, what was next? I mean, you already had this relationship with Indiana Landmarks. What else had to happen to make sure this place was saved the right way?
Well, there was a lot going on inside. So we had good contractors, a good architect who went in and evaluated things, told us what we could and maybe couldn't salvage. So we had a lot of help. It wasn't just us. And, you know, the Vision of Landmarks, they'd done such a great job on the restoration of the front of the house. They had raised the pitch of the roof that made the upper loft more accessible and usable as a master suite. A lot of the pre-work was done before we got there. And then we had a great team who helped us kind of, you know, realize the vision.
Had you ever done anything like this before, restored a house?
Tim and I both live in Cottage Home neighborhood in Indianapolis, and we live in an 1890s Vonnegut and Bohm designed double. I've done work in this house over the years, and Tim and I have done some projects in the house, so we're not new to it.
Yeah, but did that kind of prepare you for this, or was it kind of a whole different set of problems with this house?
Yeah, I think that the extent of the inside was really more than we really thought initially. But it was not, of course, we're excited about it now, but it was not something so far out of our reach that we couldn't dream about moving to the next level and getting it repaired. But it was in pretty rough shape. And Ed has said it, and I echo it. Landmarks did an amazing job in actually just saving the house, just stopping it from deteriorating anymore, which was amazing because it was in pretty rough shape.
And Tim, one of the landmarks featured in the book, yours, or rather of the landmarks featured in the book, yours is one of the most recent, I guess. When did you finally buy it?
So we started a conversation with Paul Hayden, the representative in the Wabash area for Indiana Landmarks in April of 2019. We didn't close on the house. We closed in August of 2019. Of course, we had a great deal of architecture work and permits and back and forth figuring out what we could do. And we actually didn't start work on the house until late December.
And Ed, I imagine Albert's profession as a mason is one of the reasons the house has stood so long. But as you said, it was hastily built in 10 days. And as you were digging into this structure, I guess, what were some of the major problems you found out you had to solve right away? You said it was a little daunting.
There were some interesting building techniques done in the main floor where there was an unsupported brick walls that were unusual. I've never seen that kind of construction that were supported by 12 by 12 oak beams below with no reinforcing walls mm-hmm. beneath them. So although we would have loved to have saved those, they did have to come out, and we have repurposed and saved the bricks and are going to use them in a fireplace wall. So there were kind of some unusual techniques used mm-hmm. That we or our contractor had not seen. The stone floors in the basement that are still intact are kind of unusual. Gosh, I'm trying to think what else is.
Yeah, I think the brick walls and the stone floor in the basement is really the most unusual part of it. As well as I still think the double stairwell in the front is really unusual as well. You don't see that quite often.
Is there anything that you were unable to save, any part of it that you really wanted to keep, but you just had to change so dramatically that you had to say goodbye to it?
I would say the brick walls. I really like the look of it and the feel of it, but they were, I was there when the contractor just basically said, you can't have anyone in here walking around because they are about to fall in. And so we had to make that decision, unfortunately. And we looked at every way that we could to save to save it, and we just couldn't. There was just we and to Ed's point, it was not supported below as well. So it was a tremendous amount of weight on the floor and the structure with no support underneath. And so that was, it was disappointing, but we had to make that decision and move on.
Ed, what are you going to do with the house?
Well, it is going to be kind of a family overflow for around holidays when we're all up in Wabash. We have thought and are exploring the idea of an Airbnb in the area also. And Tim's kind of an expert on that stuff. And it's a good, it also has a great backyard for gardening. So we will find, I think, a lot of time to spend up there. So.
Yeah, Ed's mother is a young lady, as we would say, and we enjoy spending time with her. And so it would give us an opportunity as a second home as well to spend even more time with the family up in Wabash. So we're really excited about that.
And Ed, your mother was kind of documenting the news around the house coming up for sale back when it came up for sale. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, she's great at saving clippings of newspapers from the Wabash Plain dealer and passing them on to us. And after we had purchased the house, I think she sent us a clipping that she had meant to share earlier with us. So, and she's been through the house and definitely approves.
Ed Norman and Tim Parnell own the 170-year-old recently restored Albert House in Wabash, Indiana, that's featured in the new book, Indiana Landmarks, Rescued and Restored. Ed, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
And Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, we are live with the president of Indiana Landmarks and one of the editors of the new book to talk about many of the historic places they've helped save. And if you have questions or comments for our panel, maybe there's a property you're interested in saving, or if you have a favorite Indiana landmark, share it with us via Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about Indiana's historic buildings, specifically the ones saved by the organization Indiana Landmarks. Many of their best successes are featured in a new coffee table book called Indiana Landmarks, Rescued and Restored, which just came out. And we are live now via Skype with the president of Indiana Landmarks, Marsh Davis. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Matt. Great to be with you.
Great to be with you. And the editor of the new book is with us, Tina Connor. Hi, Tina.
Hi, Matt.
And if you have questions or comments for our panel, we would love to hear from you. Do you have a favorite Indiana landmark? Or maybe there's a place you'd like to see restored. Perhaps you have questions about a specific place Indiana Landmarks was involved in saving. Whatever you'd like to share, get it to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, and we'll try to get to it before the end of the hour. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Marsh, let's just get some basics out of the way on Indiana Landmarks. What makes your organization different from other historic preservation groups?
We are actually the largest statewide nonprofit organization in the United States. And I would say that that's based on a long history of great leadership at the volunteer level and a very talented staff over the years who have built the organization into what it is. We were founded in 1960 by business and community leaders who had a proactive and positive vision and intentionality about it. It said, you know, we want to save some landmarks for our children and for the next generation. It wasn't born of reaction or let's stop this or, you know, a lot of preservation is perceived as highly regulatory and oppositional. It was not the way we were formed. So we started on a positive foot. And I would say the other thing that distinguishes us is the reach that we have throughout the state through 9 regional offices. There is no other statewide organization that has that kind of reach and staff spread out throughout the states.
You described some historic organizations as sort of regulatory and oppositional. Go into more about that. What's an example of what an organization might do that would be that way that perhaps Indiana Landmarks would not?
Well, there are some organizations that were formed specifically to stop something from happening. And there also is a very legitimate role for the regulatory side of historic preservation, which often comes through local government, through local commissions. There's a state office of historic preservation that has a regulatory authority. And these are all very important and highly valued. But Indiana Landmarks is a nonprofit, a membership-based organization. And so our goal is to really solve problems and find proactive solutions to historic places in need.
And I'm sure that every case is different, but what is a typical scenario? Say there's an historic building for sale. I'm interested and I have the means to purchase it. Where do you come in?
Well, you're right. There is no typical example, but a common theme among many of these places is, my God, what are we going to do with it? It's beyond repair. We hear that a lot. And if you were to look at you just talked with the owners of the Alber House. When I first saw the Alber House, I talked to our director in Wabash, Paul Hayden, who was mentioned. I said, Paul, are you nuts? Look at this thing. The wall has got a crack through it that's 6 inches wide. But that's part of my role is to be the one who throws the cold showers on people to try to bring us to a sense of reality. But what that does is it causes us to find ways to solve the problem. So that's the typical common denominator in not all, but many cases that these properties are just too far gone. Nobody's going to be able to save it. And that's a role that Landmarks has played, is to find solutions to those problems.
And indeed, in the new book, there are before and after photos for nearly every property mentioned. And when you look at some of the before photos, you think, how did they do it? Because just looking at it has got to be daunting. I'm sure there are examples of properties that you've really just had to turn down because they were just so far gone and there was just absolutely no saving them.
Well, they got to be pretty bad to be in that situation. So this book illustrates a couple of examples that I might cite. But first, I want to say that so many of these efforts were really heroic, and Indiana Landmarks rarely goes at it alone. There are so many partners involved in making these projects successful. Just as with Ed and Tim and the Alber House, you know, we took it to a point, but they're the ones who carry it to completion. So I want to acknowledge right up front that our work is highly collaborative and it's based on partnerships. And this book illustrates projects where we had a critical role in whatever the positive outcome was. But by no means are we saying, hey, we did it all ourselves. Our approach to solving problems is highly, highly collaborative. But let me mention one example that's in the book. It's in Evansville. It's called the Owen Block. This building was a grand four-story, and when it was built, it was a four-unit row house, and very unusual in the state, of the grand Second Empire style. It was about as bad a condition as you could expect. And we hired an engineering firm who said, don't get near it. This thing is, you can't save it. Well, that was just kind of like throwing gas on the fire for us. So we said, let's
try us.
Yeah. So we, in short order, raised a sufficient amount of money to save the building. This is one where the neighborhood, they appealed to us that this building is so important to us, even though, you know, everybody says it can't be saved, help us save it. And that's what happened. And it's a big success. And it's a very popular event in Evansville when we were able to reopen that building.
Tina, let's get to your involvement in the organization. How far back do you go with Indiana Landmarks?
Well, I don't know if it's a point of pride or if I should be embarrassed that I started working there in 1975 and I retired at the end of 18. So I was there, you know, from very early days. I think I mentioned to you that I walked around Lockerbie Square in 1975 when more than half the buildings were empty and so dilapidated. I remember going into one that had a foot of standing water in the basement, and the back end had burnt, had had a fire, the kitchen wing. Now you go through Lockerbie and you can't imagine that it was as far gone as that. But so Landmark's role there was to buy the worst house on the block and make it the Bicentennial Office in 1976, which brought a lot of people to that neighborhood and also gave a lot of do-it-yourselfers confidence that since there was an institutional presence there, you know, maybe it wasn't as risky as it seemed. And there are people, including one of the houses in the book, who bought, they bought a different house back in the day, and now they're older and they moved to a smaller house, which was in the book with Scribner House, and have lived there all this time. It's a totally restored neighborhood now that also, I think, introduced Indianapolis to the idea of living downtown, which was not popular or common then.
We're talking to Tina Connor. She's the editor of the new book, Indiana Landmarks Rescued and Restored. We're also on with the president of Indiana Landmarks. And we would love your thoughts on historic preservation this hour. You can reach us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. And of course, we are talking because the new book, Indiana Landmarks Rescued and Restored, has just come out. So, Tina, how did the idea for this book come about?
You know, we had a donor, Sally Rowland, who was also a board member, who I think, and Marsh, who had the idea that a book would be a popular way to tell our story. And she helped, she contributed money that helped make it possible.
And Marsh, as much as I would like to kind of stay away from this topic this hour, I feel like we have to talk about it. Had you planned anything special for the release of the book that got disrupted by the pandemic?
Yes, good question. We have an annual fundraiser here called Rescue Party, and it's a great festive event held in late April. And our plan was to auction a first special edition of this book. At that event. And then we had a series of rollouts planned throughout the state where we'd go, not just here in Indianapolis, but in all the regions, all of our nine regions would have an event to promote the book and the local landmarks featured in it. We had to set that aside in the interest of the public health.
And of course, it sounds like that event is kind of it could be a fundraising event for your organization. And how much has that, I guess, impacted your organization's bottom line? Are you worried about repercussions from the pandemic at all?
Yes, we are, as nearly everybody is. It's hitting us all in different ways. We do rely on a lot of events and programs and tours. It's not the mainstay of our finances, but it is important. So, yes, we're going to take some revenue hits. And that's why we appreciate all the more the support we have from our members and donors and from the community. The Rescue Party, for instance, that in itself will be about $100,000 hit to our budget.
Mm. Would you say, though, that there is any kind of silver lining to releasing the book now at a time when people are finding themselves stuck at home?
Yes. In a very wonderful way, this gives us a chance to stay in touch with people. We're sending out many copies of this book to people who have supported our organization over time, people that we are physically separated from now. And the comments I'm getting back from those who've received the book are just really glowing. You think this is really just reminds us of the work that we're all doing around the state. And I've also heard from some of our close friends who've been with us and are very supportive. They said, "My gosh, we had no idea how many projects you've been involved with." And to that, I would say, "Well, this is just a sampling of our work. Part of the problem, the challenges of this putting this book together was winnowing down the number of wonderful projects and places. We just could only feature a few of them, and Tina had the rough job of trying to condense it all into a very, very concise and brightly flowing text. So, this is a sampling of our work.
Yeah, if Tina, what? Oh, go ahead.
I could add that the winnowing was in part a function because we wanted it to be a before and after book. We had to have good before images that would reproduce well in a four-color large format book. And so it's not by any means the best necessarily. It doesn't represent the cream of the crop. I hope it represents a sampling from individual houses to neighborhoods to industrial buildings retooled for a new purpose, kind of across the range of sorts of projects that we've been engaged with. But I hope people recognize if they were involved in a project and don't see it in the book, it's probably because it didn't have good enough before images that would reproduce well. And then I'd also like to credit the after photos, which are heavily taken by our staff, but also by some volunteer photographers like Lee Llewellyn and Bob Zyromsky, who drove all over the state for us to take pictures on a volunteer basis that are just excellent.
We are getting some messages on Facebook. Sharla sent us a message. She says, we love the Culbertson Mansion in New Albany, Indiana. We want to make sure it stays as a historic site forever. And Jake says, I live in Lafayette, Indiana, and I'm very proud of our local preservation organizations, including Indiana Landmarks, who helps continue to showcase our very own Frank Lloyd Wright home. But recently, a struggle to save and restore our few remaining brick streets has become an issue. Some are in protected neighborhoods, some have been designated historic districts, but others, like the one I grew up by, are in severe condition and not in a historically significant neighborhood. Without a neighborhood association and with limited funds by the city to keep it in repair, what are your suggestions for preserving brick streets that add so much character and historic significance to an area? Marsh, do we have an answer for Jake?
One start might, you mentioned that these are streets that are in an area that do not have local leadership in the way of a neighborhood association. In my experience in the places where we have worked with communities to preserve their brick streets, including the neighborhood where I live in Indianapolis, it starts with the local neighborhood association. And that is one of the most important tools that we've had as far as partnerships in saving properties. Starts in many cases with that local leadership. So if you don't have that that tool in your community, that's often a good place to start. Without it, it's much, much more difficult.
Marsh, I would imagine the obstacles against historic preservation are numerous. What do you find yourselves often battling with regard to people who are sort of getting in the way of things? What are some of the most common arguments for not saving a site from people?
One common argument is not without merit, and that is that the cost involved in many projects is sometimes rather high. And this is one of the challenges that we have throughout the state, where you have real estate markets, for instance, that are not as strong as they are in others. You can have a wonderful property in a community, in one community, and the same property in another community, and their values will be radically different. So that's one of the challenges we have is finding people who are willing to make that investment and working with, some cases with community foundations, with local government, and others to help subsidize some of the costs involved in saving these properties. And go back to the Alber House, for instance, in Wabash, since you featured that. It did not make, at face value, it did not make any sense to save that property from an economic standpoint. So we partnered with the city. The city was going to spend money to demolish the property. So, well, instead of spending that money to demolish a house, why not invest that in the project? So that in itself helped offset some of the upside down budget that we had when we went into it.
What are some go ahead, Tina.
If I could add a couple of examples in Indianapolis, or one in Indianapolis and West Baden, part of it, I think, is imagination, is having the ability to look at a place and see what it might become And that's hard for people when it's half crashed in or water's been flowing through the building for a while. In the case of Busch Stadium, the infield was filled with cash for clunkers cars for years. And so the idea that you could retool a baseball stadium for something as different as apartments takes some vision and some imagination. And I think Marsh and the other folks at Landmarks have that in abundance. And we recruit help from people who share that, like John Watson, who's the developer of Busch Stadium Lofts. And in the case of West Baden, where we had a national real estate expert tell us to call it a ruin and let people crawl on it.
Tina, we will get to more on West Baden in the next segment. I cannot wait to talk about West Baden. We are marking the release of the new book, Indiana Landmarks Rescued and Restored, with Marsh Davis, the president of Indiana Landmarks, and Tina Connor, the book's editor. Up next, we'll hear about more of the places featured in the book and some that aren't, but are still significant to Indiana's history. And we'll take your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We're back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our show on historic preservation in Indiana. We're doing this show because Indiana Landmarks just put out a new coffee table book called Rescued and Restored. We're here with the editor of the book, Tina Connor, and the organization's president, Marsh Davis. And as always, we would love for you to be part of the conversation. Do you have a favorite historic building in Indiana? What do you like about it? Or if you have questions about a particular place Indiana Landmarks has helped to preserve or one you think they should be a part of, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We'll do our best to get it in before the end of the hour. That's 866-476-3881. So, Tina, just before the break, you started talking about West Baden Springs Hotel in French Lick, which is... Marsh, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like it's probably the crown jewel of Indiana Landmarks these days. It's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, success stories. It was built in 1902, and at one time it was called the eighth wonder of the world by some. Tina, can you just walk us through that, starting with the shape it was in by the mid-90s?
Yes, well, in the early part of the century when it was built, 14 trains a day came into French Lick and West Baden. That's the way most people traveled there. From all parts of the country, it was advertised in New York City and in North Dakota. And it was a spa hotel. You came to take the waters, which were supposed to cure everything from cancer to eczema and everything in between. And, of course, it didn't really do that. But in those days, the science wasn't as advanced. And a scientist who was writing at the time said, you know, if you came to a place where you relaxed, where you were away from the stress of your daily life, where you took exercise you didn't normally take because there was golf and horseback riding and tennis and bicycle riding and walking, and you drank lots of water, which is good for you, of course you would feel better. And so many people did come there for months at a time. And it spawned other hotels in the area, smaller ones, maybe less expensive for people who didn't have quite the means to stay at the really fancy West Baden Springs Hotel and French Lick, which is only a mile away. But the Depression did West Baden in as a hotel. And it then became a Jesuit monastery for 30 years, and then it became a private college. But by the 80s, it was vacant and deteriorating. And then in the early 90s, a portion of the exterior wall collapsed from the sixth floor all the way down. And this is a place built around a really stunning round atrium that is 600 feet in circumference and more than 100 feet tall. So that's the really awe-inspiring space that you come into when you enter the hotel. So all of that was in jeopardy, and Landmarks shored up a portion of the outside wall that where the collapse had occurred. And we knew that that would only last about 5 years, that was kind of like orthodontia or, you know, an intervention that wasn't permanent. And so we began looking for solutions. And in the end, the Board of Landmarks said, if not us, who? If not now, when? You know, because we had come upon that 5-year limit of those reinforcing arrangements that we made. And so we bought the building. And fortunately for us, among the people we asked to help us, Marsh mentioned earlier that we always look for collaborators and partners. And no one in Indiana is better known for preservation on a private level than the Cook family in Bloomington, especially in southern Indiana, since they live in Bloomington and have a landmark property on the Ohio River. So they, in the end, said they would help us. And but in the intervening time, we did have a national real estate expert come to look at West Baden, and he said, call it a ruin and let people crawl on it. It's just too far away from major highways, from cities. It's too dilapidated. There's just no solution. But, you know, what we discovered by restoring, and initially we were going to restore the outside and the atrium and make it less scary and try to find a buyer, which is often what we do. But in this case, thousands of people wanted to tour it. And so the Cook family concentrated on the restoration, and we concentrated on development incentives and on allowing people to see it, to broaden its awareness of people and broaden its appeal. And all of those things worked together so that when the legislature passed the last gaming license for French Lick West Baden, that was the kind of final thing that made it possible to restore it as a hotel, because originally we weren't thinking it would be a hotel again. We weren't sure what it would be. Sort of like Busch Stadium becoming an apartment building. We didn't know in the early days what it might be used for, but we just thought it was important to save. And that was the case with West Baden too. But finally, the Cook family said, you know, for everything we've done to it so far, let's just finish it. And, you know, it just couldn't be a more satisfying result. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place. And up until the pandemic, we did tours every day of the week. And people who maybe couldn't afford to stay there could still afford to take a tour and walk through the place and be wowed by the atrium as they were in 1902.
Wow. Marsh, it's becoming clear that we could do an entire hour on the West Baden Springs Hotel, but I would like to get to a few of the other properties. Tina, thank you for sharing that. And one of the ones, Marsh, that you were really involved in was one that you say was an unlikely save, just as it sounds like the West Baden Springs Hotel could have very well been an unlikely save. And the one that I'm referring to is Newkirk Mansion in Connersville. Why was that a close call?
Well, the Newkirk Mansion was a grand, overscaled place that, again, in a rather challenging real estate market. And our role there was to arrest the decay. In this case, we exercised an option on the property. And as I mentioned earlier on, that part of our role is to serve as a matchmaker through listing properties. So one way is on our 10 most endangered list. It raises awareness. Gets people to care about places, and the Newkirk Mansion landed on our 10 most endangered list. And through that, we were able to recruit the interest of a potential buyer. But there was just too much of a gap between the sales price and what the purchaser was willing to offer. So Landmarks filled that gap, and it was an investment well worth it. And now the property is in good hands, but it was a very difficult property in terms of again the real estate market and finding a buyer. So as Tina mentioned, it takes vision, but also takes a pretty good promotion too, and that's a lot of what we do through our programs, not the least of which is our 10 most endangered list.
Tina, another spot that's featured in the book is one that I didn't know about when I happened to pass it on a trip through southern Indiana 6 years ago. It was Beck's Mill. I passed it, and I just had to turn around and go back and look at it again. It's this old picturesque mill with a water wheel, and I just stared at it until my wife snapped me out of it. Tell me about Beck's Mill.
Beck's Mill is in just outside of Salem, Indiana. It was built in, I think, 1860s and continuously operated and then just closed and was mothballed. And mothballed, it just closed. And so if you can imagine, over time, decade after decade, it deteriorated. And the local folks there were really concerned and tried to convince the family that owned it and had owned it for decades to sell it or let go of it, give it to someone, and could never make that match. But finally, we were able to help do that. And I remember asking Bill Cook when we were working on West Baden if he was aware of Beck's Mill and might they consider helping with that. And he said, talk to me after West Baden's finished. Mm. And sure enough, they asked to show up at a board meeting of the local nonprofit. That we did manage to help get the building, get the family that owned it to sell the building. And so the locals were trying to cobble together grants, and we were helping them and loans that Landmarks had provided. And then the Cook family showed up at a board meeting of this little nonprofit and said, why don't you help us? Let us help you do this. And they restored the mill completely inside and out, and some of the grounds around, got the water wheel working again. And Carl Cook, who's an engineer, also orchestrated it so that it might eventually sell power back to the grid by running the wheel and generating its own electricity.
Wow.
It's a great story. And the locals now operate it as a museum seasonally, or they did until the pandemic. This is a point that a lot of museums and historic places are facing this summer and maybe for the next couple of years until there's a vaccine. And so anyone who has one of these places in their community, I hope they'll be generous and continue to contribute to these places to make sure that they can keep a solid roof on them and keep the utilities working until things gear back up again.
We are marking the release of the new book, Indiana Landmarks Rescued and Restored, with the president of Indiana Landmarks, Marsh Davis, and Tina Connor, the book's editor. Marsh, there's so much in this book that has a history that would come as a surprise to people who aren't aware of what happened there. I'm thinking right now of Lyle Station School. What's special about that site?
Lyle Station was one of the historic African American settlements, in this case in far southwest Indiana, outside of Princeton, and we believe it is the last surviving African American farming community in the state. And the chief landmark in that community, which really was holding the whole thing together as a place, was the school. A school built, I think, around 1920. It had an excellent history as far as the educational quality. But when consolidation occurred in the 1950s, the building was left vacant. And this is one that the people would say, well, you can save that. You can save anything, because it was really falling in. But it took years of work trying to find a way to save it. And ultimately, thanks to some very clever thinking from associates in Washington, we were able to find some, in this case, federal dollars that led to a total restoration. And today it is a vibrant community center, has a little bit of a museum to it. It has a heritage classroom where students from the region can come and experience a day in the life of a schoolhouse in the 1920s. The leader down there is Stanley Madison, who has just been an absolute saint to work with and keeps this place going. But if we had let that school go, I fear that Lyle Station would only exist now in books and on paper. Now it's a physical place that people can experience, and it's one of the true treasures in our state.
And it's represented in Washington, D.C. at the African American Museum that's associated with the Smithsonian.
Oh, wow. And it is, it's just another It's another perfect example of really looking at these properties in the book and just wondering how in the world you were able to save something like that. Marsha, I completely understand what you mean. You look at the before and after photos of Lisle Station School, and it's really, really striking.
Tina, yeah, Matt, that's one of the better before pictures. It got a lot worse after that picture was taken, believe me.
Tina, naturally, the very building where Indiana Landmarks is headquartered is one that the organization has saved. Can you tell us about the former Central Avenue Methodist Episcopal Church?
Yes. It was built in phases before and after the turn of the century. The sanctuary, then the Sunday school, and then the office building attached, and it was vacant and in bad shape, and a local nonprofit had taken it over after the Methodists left. But back in its early days, it was the largest Methodist church in the state. It helped start St. Luke's Methodist Church up on 86th Street. But after it did that in the 50s, it dwindled until when it closed, it only had about 26 members to maintain this enormous plant. And in our case, we owned the Morris Butler House, which is right behind it. So we had been paying attention to it for years and tried to help it, giving them grants. But when they finally threw in the towel, this nonprofit, it was just too daunting a task to raise the money to restore it. They wanted to just hand us the keys because we had given them a recoverable grant. And Marsh took a lot of experts, a lot of developers through, and that was during the last recession, and it just wasn't going to pencil out for anybody. And that's when he started thinking, you know, we've been saying that we wanted a place where we could do more programming. We had restored a building and had our office on Michigan Street on the canal in downtown Indianapolis, but we had a boardroom that wouldn't even hold our entire board, so we could hardly do many public programs there. And so we envisioned being able to use that for our own programs and to lease it out for weddings and receptions and meetings, conferences, and help pay for it that way in an ongoing manner. And once we asked Bill Cook and Gail and Carl Cook if they might consider helping us. And, you know, what they like to do, unlike a lot of philanthropists, instead of giving you money and you do it, they do it. And so it was this double gift. They restored it and it opened in, I think, 2011. Is that right, Marsh?
That's right.
And it has done just exactly what we hoped it would up until this pandemic.
Of course.
You know, part of being able to lease it for weddings, which it just makes a wonderful venue because it's sort of like a church, but not a church, which appeals to many people. And it has been used for both religious and secular sorts of weddings. And then the old Sunday school, which is beautiful and makes a great place for a reception. But all of that revenue has gone by the wayside now for the foreseeable future. So as Marsh said, we'll have to be pulling our belt and hope we can weather this current.
Indeed. Well, I mean, it is clear that we could spend a lot more time with the both of you, and I wish that we could, but we'll have to leave it there. She is the editor of the new book, Indiana Landmarks Rescued and Restored, which is available now at indianalandmarks.org. Tina Connor, thank you.
Thank you.
And Marsh Davis, president of Indiana Landmarks. Marsh, thanks for your time.
Matt, thank you so much for having us on the show.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we'll look at how Indiana's religious communities are doing and what they're deciding to do now that the state says they're free to gather in person. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.